Hi, Katie.
Hello, have you recovered from your biscuit?
Yeah, sorry, I hope I won't be like salivating into the microphone too much.
Dropping crumbs onto it.
There's a pop shield to protect the microphone from the crumbs. Amazing invention. That's what it's there for, yeah?
It's not what it's there for. And you shouldn't be eating biscuits while recording this. We're more professional than that.
I'm sorry, we just had a meeting and, you know...
You got very hungry.
Yeah.
It happens. How are you apart from your insatiable addiction to biscuits?
Yeah, I've been consuming a lot of culture this week. So I've got like a long list of isolation inspiration at the end of the show. But one thing, I finally watched Sister Act 2. And... it's amazing. Can we just like agree that Lauryn Hill is the best singer in the world?
I haven't seen this film for a very long time. This is the one that ends with the massive montage of the high school students singing. What are they singing?
Joyful, Joyful, which is the European anthem.
Oh, yeah.
Which is why I'm talking about it. I mean,
can we have a little clip of it?
Yeah.
Joyful, joyful, Lord, we adore thee.
So that is basically a reworking of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, which is the European anthem.
I feel like the European Union needs to employ Lauryn Hill to actually make the EU seem kind of cool. She could achieve it where many have failed.
Yeah, that's true. Although, actually, we're speaking to someone later on in the show that did a pretty good job at that already with a new TV show, don't you think?
I don't know if he made it seem cool, but he made it seem really funny. And I thought that was hard enough. But yeah, we're going to be talking to the French screenwriter, Noé Desprez, about his new TV series that hit screens in France recently, Parlement. It is a sharp and very funny satire about the inner workings of the European Union. And Dominic and I have been enjoying it greatly as part of our lockdown viewing.
Yeah, and even if you aren't living in France or Belgium and don't have access to this program, we had a really interesting chat about Europe and culture and satire. So yeah, I think it'll be an interesting listen.
I hear you have a commemoration corner this week.
It's quite a big commemoration corner week this week, seeing as it's 75 years since the end of the Second World War in Europe. VE Day, or Victory in Europe Day, takes place in most of the continent on the 8th of May, but in certain former Soviet bloc countries and Russia, it's celebrated on the 9th of May. For most of us, this coming Friday marks the day that the Allies formally accepted the surrender of the armed forces of Nazi Germany. And around this period, naturally, is also the time when a lot of European countries were liberated. Just to name a few of them, there was Italy that was liberated on the 25th of April. Denmark celebrated their Liberation Day on the 5th of May. And the Netherlands, where I live, also celebrated liberation on the 5th of May, although part of the country had been liberated much earlier. So whilst obviously most of the planned commemorations can't go ahead for obvious C-word reasons, there have been lots of two-minute silences around. I can't decide whether to tell a story about my Dutch friend who's in Belgium, and they're doing the two-minute silence at the same time that the Belgians are clapping for the health workers.
Oh, God. The situations thrown up by this lockdown are endlessly brilliant and hilarious and boring and terrible.
Yeah, so that's probably not great for Belgian-Dutch relations. But there will be lots of big televisual commemorations going on across the continent, so I'm sure you will all be aware of it this week. And yeah, it's important we commemorate this so that we just never forget this awful chapter in Europe and the world's history. And now for an awkward segue into talking about our wonderful Patreon supporters.
Nicely done, Dominic. Yes. Before we go on, we want to say thank you to the many generous people who are helping us through this time of slightly reduced employment by supporting us on Patreon. The latest brilliant people to sign up are Ivo Andrich, James Kingdon, Andrew Daigler, Sarah Hinckley, Ian Martin, and Melanie Jayantha.
Thank you, lovely patrons. We have our first ever Europeans pub quiz on the horizon. More details will be coming in the next few days. But you could join us for this pub quiz, or if that sounds like hell, you could join us anyway and give a few pennies a month. Not pennies, actually. It's in dollars, annoyingly.
Dollars. Let's be real.
Head to patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Who's had a good week, Katie?
It has been a good week for Vilnius, capital of Lithuania. I've got a bit of a soft spot for this city, not only because I went there to record a special episode of this very podcast last year, but also because before that, you may remember that the local tourist board ran a really memorable publicity campaign for the city, which branded Vilnius as the G-spot of Europe, with the tagline, "Nobody knows where it is, but once you find it, it's amazing." But anyway, yeah, I'm giving good week to Vilnius this week because the city has scored another couple of PR coups this week. The first one was the decision to turn the city's airport into a massive open-air cinema. Flights in and out of Vilnius are down to almost zero at the moment, and there is a lot of space at the airport. So the people behind the city's international film festival thought, do you know what? Why don't we just turn it into a drive-in cinema? So that's what they're doing for at least the rest of the month. They have put a massive screen on the runway.
What happens if you need the toilet in the middle of the film?
Ooh, bring a bottle? I don't know, that's a good question. I'm not entirely sure about all of the logistics, but I do know that the cars all have to park 2 meters apart. It is €15 a car, and the money goes to support the film festival, which obviously along with the rest of the culture industry is like really struggling right now. So I think it's a really good idea.
I think driving gigs and driving cinemas are really going to be taking off the next few months. I heard the English National Opera in London, just near actually where my parents live, are going to be doing a drive-in opera in a car park. And I was reading about this Danish pop star, Mads Lange, who's doing gigs in a car park as well. So it's a great solution.
The first film to air last week in Vilnius was Parasite, the South Korean film that swept the Oscars, of course. And they're going to be showing loads of brilliant films from around the world over the next few weeks. So yeah, super cool. The other nice headline that you might have seen about Vilnius over the past week is that the city is basically planning on turning into a massive outdoor cafe as it emerges from lockdown. Obviously, the question of how to reopen restaurants and bars in a safe way has been proving a nightmare in the city, as it has been everywhere. And Vilnius has come up with a really nice solution. It sounds very smart and actually quite charming. We'll see how well it works. But the basic idea is to let restaurants and bars set up their tables outside on the pavements and in public squares so that they can spread out while actually starting to do business again. Like I say, it remains to be seen how well the idea will work in practice, but it's going down really well with local businesses. About 160 have applied so far to take up this offer to use public spaces in this way. So it's kind of cool. I'm just really intrigued by the fact that Vilnius seems to have such a high concentration of PR geniuses, despite being a very small city.
Yeah,
I think we need to do a special episode about it.
Yeah, maybe we should just make this podcast a Vilnius podcast. Although we actually have another contender for geographic location that we talk about too much, and that is Poland. And I'm afraid Bad Week is not going to Poland, but it is a Polish issue.
I'm listening.
It's been a bad week for Netflix in Poland after the government announced what has been dubbed the Netflix tax as part of their latest package of measures responding to the current health and economic crisis. The plan is to charge a 1.5% tax on any revenues from streaming services. So actually, despite the cute Netflix tax name that's been given, it's not just Netflix who will have to pay up. The money raised will be going to the Polish Institute of Film Art to help promote the development of Polish cinema. And the measure is expected to raise more than 20 million zloty each year, which is, I think, about 4.4 million euros.
Not bad.
What do we know about the Polish Institute of Film Art? Well, it's state-run, so I was immediately a little bit suspicious, having covered quite a lot of negative stories about the Polish government lately. But they do seem to support some genuinely brilliant and important films, like the Oscar-winning Ida from Paweł Pawlowski. And also they co-funded that documentary about Renia Spiegel, the Polish Jewish teenager who we talked about a few months back with Anya Jakubek. So they can't be all bad. And perhaps it doesn't need reiterating. As Katie said, cultural industries are one of the many sectors that are going through very difficult times right now. And the big companies like Netflix, Disney Plus, Amazon Prime and Spotify are some of the few companies who actually might be benefiting from this current crisis, as we're all stuck at home and not consuming any other culture. So yeah, I'm sure many of you have experienced that you may be watching a little bit more TV than normal if you don't have children. I don't have official statistics from each of these companies in Europe, but the few figures around subscriptions that we have seen have looked very good for the streaming giants, particularly for the newest face on the block, Disney Plus. Therefore, it seems like a very sensible bit of policymaking to find a way to tax these companies who otherwise are taking a lot of European money and not paying much tax, if any, in the European countries themselves.
Isn't there already legislation that says that Netflix et al. Have to produce, is it 30% minimum European content?
Yeah, so we talked about that before. There's this EU-wide legislation that demands that 30% of the output from streaming services has to be made in Europe. So there are actually already some quite successful Polish-made shows on Netflix. There's one that I've been meaning to watch, 1983, which is an alternative reality crime drama in which the Iron Curtain had never fallen and Poland is still under communist rule.
Can I just chip in with another trashier recommendation?
Yeah.
The Witcher was very, like, bad, good. We watched it a bit in this household. And Poles are quite obsessed with that series, aren't they? Because it's this sort of fantasy series that's based on a bunch of Polish books and video games.
Yes, exactly it is. And it was meant to be the new Game of Thrones. And I'm not sure whether it quite took off like that.
Poland isn't the first country to try taxing this lot, all these internet giants, is it?
No, indeed, they're not. And in fact, the EU have been trying to create a block-wide policy, and there had been a plan last year to impose a 3% levy on the huge multinational tech companies. But thank you, Ireland, Finland and Sweden, they blocked that. Ooh. So the ball is currently in individual countries' courts, and France actually passed its own 3% digital services tax back in July last year, but in the end decided to delay its implementation after the US threatened tit-for-tat levies on French imports. Don't you love it when I talk about tax? So that one is still stuck in the starting blocks. The EU are thinking again about how to tax these companies that are taking so much of our European money and paying very little, if any, back. And the Economy Commissioner, Paolo Gentiloni, has actually recently been discussing again how the current crisis accelerates the need to put some kind of digital taxation policy in place. But in the meantime, Poland has gone and enacted their own measures, and because they are currently limited to the streaming services, perhaps they'll get away without any of that tit-for-tat US retaliation. Let's see. But anyway, yeah, I wanted to talk about this story not only because I'm interested in it, but also because we've been talking about quite a few bits of really bleak news from Poland recently. So when I heard about this new law, I thought we should cover it, even though we talk about Poland all the time. Not that we should forget the fact that there is, you know, there's still meant to be an election happening in Poland this Sunday. And at the time of recording, we don't know what's happening with that. And it's a bit scary because loads of the opposition politicians have said this is not a legitimate election. So sorry to bring it back to bleak things in Poland, but yeah, bad week for Netflix.
Let's now go into the belly of the European beast, Brussels. On this podcast, we have often found ourselves in the role of being a couple of outsiders trying to peer into the Brussels bubble and like work out how it works, which can be quite confusing because the workings of the EU are complicated. Someone else who finds himself in this position is the protagonist of the new French TV show Parlement. Sammy is a hapless parliamentary assistant who turns up in Brussels and realizes he doesn't know anything about how stuff works there.
We talked all night, man. She's so nice, she's funny. And
she's a Nazi.
What?
She's a Nazi. The Democrats of Sweden, they're Nazis.
No, they cannot be Nazis because Nazis doesn't exist anymore.
Nazis isn't like dodos or polar bears. I mean, they can disappear and then come back again.
But wait, like, they're Democrats and from Sweden. It's like two things everybody loves.
Yeah, that's because everything is the opposite of what it's named here.
Noé Debré is one of the writers behind it. He's kind of a big deal in the world of French screenwriting, Dominic. He won a Palme d'Or at Cannes Film Festival before he turned 30.
Disgusting.
It is disgusting. But anyway, we were really intrigued by this latest project of Noé's. He's helped write films about all kinds of things, from cowboys to the experiences of refugees living in France. So we started by asking him why he wanted to make a series about the European Union.
Well, I grew up in Strasbourg. So, you know, the parliament, the building of the parliament was always somewhere in the landscape. So I think that's probably one of the main reasons that I was, you know, just curious to know what was going on in there. And I sort of have also the intuition that, you know, this place with several people from different places and everything, to me, sounded like good fiction material.
I was kind of curious about your upbringing in Strasbourg. Like, if you grow up in that city, do you kind of grow up knowing how all of this stuff works? Or did you have to do a kind of a crash course in how all the institutions work when you were making this show?
I think when you grow up in Strasbourg, you sort of get more of education about the European institution than else in France, I guess. But there's the big difference between what you learn of how things work on paper and, you know, how they actually are done. And so it made a huge difference when I started, you know, meeting people. And then when I met with Maxime and Pierre, my two of my co-writers who are Eurocrats, you know, it's the same thing as like you read a book about any sort of organization and then you actually hear people tell you how it works when they're in the corridors and when they go to the office and what they do. And it's, you know, very different things.
How receptive were insiders in talking to you, and how receptive were the institutions themselves? I mean, I think you actually filmed some of it in the parliamentary buildings, didn't you?
Yes. Well, for documentation, everybody was really open in the institutions. Most of them understand that probably the biggest issue is the absence of representation in a way, or at least in citizens' imagination. So people are very open to publicize what they do. I mean, there was a big campaign on from the production company to be able to shoot inside the parliament. We basically couldn't have been able to reproduce it. We didn't have the budget, so we actually needed for the show to exist to be able to shoot, you know, like in plenary rooms, in, you know, commission rooms. All of this we could not have built ourselves. You know, people were nice and good reception from people in a way, though we did need to make clear that even though the show was, you know, comedy and satire and sometimes a bit mean, still the institution as a whole was going to benefit from it.
Lots of people think of Brussels as essentially a boring place where boring stuff happens. What made you think that it could work well as a setting for a comedy?
Look, I can understand why people think it's boring. I think it's not that it's boring, it's that it's complicated. And to me, the fact that it's complicated is what makes it interesting. One thing is that for screenwriters, it's great to have a place that hasn't been used in fiction before, because everything is interesting. You see what I mean? Like now, if you had to ask me to write a show that happens in a police station, it would be really hard for me because, you know, we've seen so many of those. Whereas like you go to Brussels or Strasbourg and then you film there and everything is new. And so everything is interesting. So it makes my job actually easier. And then, yeah, I think the complexity of it is fun in a way, you know, like I think comedy is a good approach for that kind of complexity. And I think it gives a lot of situation. We didn't have to invent so many things. When you watch the show, I mean, the situations are all mostly things that Pierre and Maxime, my co-writer, said, that's the way it happens. And then we turned it into comedy.
It's quite a sharp satire. You don't pull any punches. And there are a lot of very cringy moments and people who are really bad at their jobs. Were you at all concerned that you would be contributing to some already pretty negative impressions that many people have of the European Parliament?
Well, you know, I think there's like the superficial aspect to it, which is, yes, yeah, you see some MEPs that are lazy or incompetent and you see, you know, lobbyists trying to sneak in, stuff like that. But I think that's all quite superficial. It's like the first layer. But then if you look at the deep story the season is trying to convey, it's all about a guy who doesn't care about Europe, no politics, no sort of anything, happens to be there. And then throughout the first season, he's going to grow a political conscience. He's going to learn how to navigate those institutions. And at the end, he's actually going to succeed or not to have an amendment voted. And I think, you know, if people are like on the edge of their seat by the 10th episode, watching a scene of a vote of an amendment, then I think, you know, we've done a good job. I feel like everybody sees in the show what they want to see or whatever their preconception is. You know, people who are against Europe say, oh, that's exactly what I thought it was. And then people who are for it say, oh, it's so nice to be able to relate to it. You know, so I don't think it's going to switch anyone.
Yeah, I have to say, despite all the cringiness of all these situations, after watching every episode, I thought, I'd really like to work in the European Parliament, which is quite impressive that you managed to create this kind of charm to it, despite all the awkwardness.
Was it just that you were attracted by all those scenes of like people getting free drinks and snacks, Dominic?
Perhaps, yeah. That was a part of it.
You know, I do think that it's exciting to work there and the place is exciting. I mean, there's this thing like whenever I would go, I was like coming back, I was a bit melancholic about it because it feels like a never-ending foreign student exchange year or something. It's pretty exciting.
The show was a co-production between France, Belgium and Germany. Did you feel like you had to try to appeal to different senses of humour in different countries? Or do you think the humour of this show is pretty universal?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we've been wondering about that. We had like in the writer's room, we had like one British writer with us. So we were three French and one British. So we were more or less confident about those two audiences, let's say. But, you know, first test was the casting. Like, would, you know, German actors, would they relate to the show? Would they find the scripts funny? So we had sort of those steps. Then at no point did we think, we can't do that joke because those are not going to get it. You know, I think we're so used to watch American comedy with so many American references all the time that I don't always get. And it's okay. Like, you know, I don't mind. So, you know, sometimes we also have jokes that are a bit Americans. They say inside baseball kind of jokes about the European institutions. And it's the same thing. I like that when I'm watching a show that I don't understand everything. And then for the sense of humor per se, like for the comedy, I mean, there's obviously a, you know, specific type of comedy depending on where you go. But I do think that comedy can travel well. That's at least my experience of it.
I found it really funny, and I often don't find French comedies that funny.
Should you be saying
this? Maybe I shouldn't be saying this on air. I was wondering, do you think now we've had political satire about the EU institutions, are you going to go on and now make the European version of The West Wing? Because we also need a political drama, I think, for these EU institutions set in the Commission.
I think it's hard to do The West Wing today just because the state of the world is so different. You know, like when you watch The West Wing, I don't know if you watched it recently, but it feels so naive. Mm. And you see like this president that is great and he's doing all those great things. And, you know, like this social democratic sense of history that we're going in the right direction and that we're, you know, defeating the forces of reaction or whatever. And you watch it today and you can't help, you know, thinking, oh, my God, this is like Paradise Lost, you know. And I feel like if you try to do that today, whether in Brussels or in Washington or wherever, it would feel a bit off, I think. I think that's why we, you know, our generation, or I mean, our time is getting shows that are more in the sense of Veep or House of Cards, is because it follows the, I don't want to say disillusions, but yeah, of politics. And I think in that sense, I think Parliament is actually not quite as harsh and disillusioned as Veep or House of Cards. I think it's a, you know, even though all the jokes and stuff, I think it's a pretty earnest show about democracy.
Has making the show changed the way that you feel about Europe?
Actually, in both ways. Like, I feel more informed about its liabilities or weaknesses and more informed about its ambitions and what it allows. So I'm personally very Europhile. I didn't do that show to promote Europe in any way, but I was always curious about Europe. And, you know, now I have strange habits like reading Politico, and I know who those people are. So I feel more equipped to understand what's going on.
I like the description of reading Politico as a strange habit. I also have that strange habit. It's currently available to view in France and Belgium, but is it coming to any other countries anytime soon?
It's coming to Germany in June because we got co-financed by Germany and Belgium. So that's set. And now I think now they're trying to sell the show elsewhere. So we'll see. We hope it's going to get, you know, it's going to travel, but we don't know yet.
Parlement is now out on France TV. And even if you're outside France, which both of us are right now, you can watch it with a VPN.
That's illegal, Katie. We cannot suggest that.
It's legal. You can use Holo. It's a completely legal VPN service.
Yeah, using the VPN service is legal, but promoting it is illegal. Promoting people to break the law.
Oh, but it's you're watching the adverts and everything. So what's wrong with it?
The adverts are in French, so that's not who they're paying.
Well, I was about to say that this series, and I think the adverts, can be enjoyed even if you don't speak French. I mean, you don't speak very good French, and you still enjoyed it, because quite a lot of it's in English.
Yeah, that's because my Chrome browser, turns out Google translated the subtitles.
That's clever.
It was really clever.
You said you had a bunch of TV recommendations. What did you want to talk about?
Oh, not TV. Culture. Yeah, I've been consuming culture this week like the biscuits I'm eating. I'm just gorging on them. And yeah, I watched Sister Act 1 and 2, which was very exciting. I also watched Fleabag Live, which is Phoebe Waller-Bridge's original theatre version, the one-woman show that the TV show was made out of, which I imagine most of you have seen. And if you haven't, go and watch that both seasons immediately because it's the best thing that's been made on TV in the last 10 years, other than Parlement.
And Borgen.
And Borgen, which is coming back. But I also discovered a really nice live concert series that's happening on Arte, the European Arts Channel. Is it a European Arts Channel?
Yeah, it's like French and German, isn't it?
Yeah. Hope at Home. It comes from the house of the violinist and conductor Daniel Hope. Basically, right at the beginning of lockdown, just before everything quite locked down, he asked Arte if they wanted to come and turn his front room into a TV studio whilst they were still allowed in and out of his house. And he set up some amazing camera equipment and lighting, and he invites other Berlin-based world-class musicians to come and play from his home, interspersed with bits of poetry, all at a safe distance, of course.
But with proper nice TV filming, because that's been the annoying thing.
Yeah.
It's been very nice enjoying all of these concerts and things, but they've all been filmed on musicians' terrible mobile phones, and it's not quite like it is in real life, is it?
Yeah, and I found it really, really such a relief to be watching good quality images and nice sound and hearing these amazing musicians. So yeah, I recommend that.
Lovely.
Maybe that's enough for this week. What about you?
Going back to France again, I've been really enjoying watching old episodes of Floyd on France, which is a British cooking show from the 1980s featuring Keith Floyd, the late TV presenter and famous bon vivant, traveling around 1980s France and cooking and drinking and insulting everyone that he meets. And it's just very charming and funny. If you're in Britain, you can get it on the BBC, but it is also all on YouTube. But again, I shouldn't be telling people that, should I?
I think you can tell people about things that are on YouTube because things that are on YouTube get taken down if they're illegally there.
Which they probably will do now that I flagged that. Sorry!
For my happy ending this week, I'm afraid I've got no metal detectors and no valuable treasures hiding away in Grandma's attic. But I did think it would be cheering to talk about the ways in which many European cities are suddenly and rapidly becoming more bicycle friendly. Due to you know what, many people have been jumping on their bikes more often in order to get in some exercise and or to avoid the horror of having to take public transport to work. And that's going to be happening more and more, I think, as our cities start to tentatively open up. That in itself is happy news, but what is even more cheering is that many city authorities are changing the road layouts to make more space for cyclists, and some of them are making these changes permanent. In Milan, 35 kilometres of bike lanes will be installed over the summer as part of a radical rethinking of the centre of the city. In Berlin, they've temporarily expanded and widened many bike lanes so that people can keep a safe distance from each other while cycling. Brussels have quickly created an extra 40 kilometres. But here comes the big one. In Paris, they are creating a whopping 650 kilometres of pop-up cycle highways.
Woohoo!
And they have also launched a 20 million euro scheme to help subsidize bike repair costs, pay for cycle training, and create temporary parking spaces.
Oh, I'm really excited about that because my bike is so rusty.
Will it count for you as someone who was already a cyclist? Because I actually think it shouldn't.
I know it shouldn't, but what are they going to do? Test me on my cycling credentials when I turn up with my rusty bike?
They should. And whilst these measures are currently temporary in Paris, it was actually already the plan of the Parisian mayor, Anne Hidalgo, to make every road in Paris cycle friendly by 2024. She's therefore suggested that if these quick changes go well and are popular, then she might make them permanent. That would make you very happy, I assume, Katie.
Very happy.
Anyway, I'm probably missing some other great examples of local initiatives to improve cities for cyclists. So actually, if you have any other good examples, then tweet them at me. And I was thinking of maybe creating a huge Twitter thread this week listing all of the amazing city improvements for cyclists in Europe.
Nice. Very good idea.
Our Twitter account is @EuropeansPod. You can also find us on Instagram @EuropeansPodcast. You can email us hello@EuropeansPodcast.com. You could find us on Facebook by typing in the Europeans Podcast, or you can go to our website, EuropeansPodcast.com. I should point out that some cities like my own in Amsterdam were already pretty damn good for cyclists, but we don't get any subsidy for our bike repairs.
You don't need them. I have to say, cycling into central London this week, it felt like cycling in Amsterdam. It really felt like the bikes ruled the roads. We were moving as a pack.
You shouldn't move too close together. Slipstreams.
Moving as a socially distanced pack. We are going underwater next week, off the coast of Norway. I think I won't say any more than that. I'll just leave it mysterious.
I wish we were actually going underwater next week. That would be so nice.
Oh, I want to go swimming so badly. I've been dreaming of swimming and ugh.
I think give it a few weeks and people will be jumping in the canals in Amsterdam.
Is that allowed?
Based on the current measures, I don't know actually.
But it is normally.
It's normally allowed. See you next week, everyone. And in the meantime, enjoy your dreams of swimming through canals and surfing on the beach. Is that what you do on a beach?
No. Go look it up on YouTube.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.